calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, should workers have the right to strike? Interesting question for our first hour. At least the first segment, we'll be getting into that with Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute in just a moment. Later on in the program, in the second hour of our program, we're going to have on a former senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, a former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, a former editor at the Wall Street Journal, conservative Paul Craig Roberts, who's going to tell us that the Bush administration is beginning to resemble the Third Reich. And in the third hour, Doug Cunningham, producer for Workers Independent News, is going to be with us to give us an update on what's going on in the labor movement and how it's being trashed, which brings us back to the first hour. Yaron Brook, the president and executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. You guys are the thinkers who, well, or Ayn Rand, arguably, who led to, in some would argue, certainly led to the libertarian movement, and some would say even led to much of the modern conservative movement. Yaron,
not proud of any of that.
And you're not proud of any of that, right. You think they all ought to go back and be just like you, ideologically pure.
That's right.
We were talking last week about a completely unrelated topic, and you made a comment, and I just let it slide by because I didn't want to change topics in midstream, but I want to come back to it.
Sure.
You made a comment that you have no problem with unions. But you want to revisit that for us here, Yaron?
Sure. As I think I mentioned, I have no problem with unions as long as they don't get any special protection by the government. So workers should be able to organize freely, but so should the owners of the companies. That is, if unions decide to strike, they can strike, but the owners have every right to fire them.
Now, the owners of the company have already organized. I mean, that's what a corporation is. It's an organization. It's a union of capital and management. Ultimately, what we have here, Yaron, is a really significant difference between the nature of how a business is put together and how a union is put together. A business is put together in the classic model of a kingdom. You have the CEO, the lord and baron of the house. You have the stockholders who play the roles, by and large, of the royal family. They're the extended royal family. And although there have been recent Supreme Court cases, U.S. cases, that have indicated that corporation CEOs don't even really need to do what the stockholders say. And if you've ever been to a stockholder meeting of a large publicly held corporation, you know the stockholders, unless you own enough stock to own a seat on the board, they laugh at you. So the whole idea of corporations is, you know, democracies owned by their owners is a joke. And then you've got the senior executives, who are essentially the princes and princesses. And then you've got the employees, who are the serfs. Now, a union, on the other hand, they elect their members. If they take positions that the majority of their members don't like, they can fire them. They can throw them out. They can call for an election anytime. Unions are democracies. Corporations are kingdoms. As somebody who is an advocate of democracy, I have a problem with this. Now, I know that most conservatives are not really advocates of democracy. Even the modern day congressional conservatives, they would say they are, and they talk about spreading democracy around the world. But the first thing they try and do is destroy unions. What's your take on this fundamental imbalance of power?
Well, that's the most original take on corporations I've heard. That's pretty good. Well, I'm not for democracy, so I don't think democracy is the standard. I think individual rights are the standard, and in this case, property rights are the standard. And a corporation is owned by a shareholder. And I agree with you, shareholders don't have as much power as they should over corporations, and I think that's primarily the consequence of government regulation. I'd love to see shareholders have more say in how corporations are run, have more influence on what happens in the executive suite, and I think that's the main problem corporations today in America face. So it's property rights. Shareholders own the company and therefore have every right to decide who gets employed, under what terms they get employed, and who gets fired and under what terms they get fired. And unions can get together. They can organize. They can work.
But hang on just a second. Why?
Because it's an issue of. if I own my home, I have every right to decide who enters and who doesn't.
We're not talking about your home, though. We're talking about something that is created. Now, hang on just a second here, Jan. Let's look at this in the abstract. Okay,
who owns the corporation? And the corporation is owned. The property belongs to the shareholders. They are legally and morally the owners of the company.
But the existence of the corporation. A corporation itself actually is not anything. It's a legal abstraction, as you well know.
Sure.
The existence of the corporation, therefore, owes its life to government authorizing its creation, authorizing its existence. So if we, the people, collectively decide that we would like to have people among us play the game of business for the purpose of making money, and we also decide that if they're going to do that, we want to make sure that they're playing the game of business and making money in order to make this a better society, then, and ultimately the game is run for the betterment of society, which means the workers as well as the owners, then why should government not be able to say to a corporation, I'm sorry, you cannot refuse to hire somebody because of the color of their skin. You cannot refuse to hire somebody because of their political beliefs. You cannot refuse to hire or their sexuality or their ethnicity. You cannot refuse to hire somebody. You cannot fire somebody simply because they're standing up for their rights as a worker in the workplace.
Well, for lots of reasons. One is I don't agree with you about the nature of a corporation. Corporations are a market phenomena that government has recognized, just like government recognizes partnerships and it recognizes the fact that I own my home. That doesn't make me dependent. It doesn't make my home belong to the government and me leasing it from it. It's my home, and the government recognizes that.
Well, the Constitution recognizes property rights. It doesn't recognize corporations.
Yeah, property
the word
rights
corporation doesn't appear in the Constitution.
The shareholders have a contract, and what the Constitution recognizes is that contract. It recognizes the property rights of shareholders over the assets of the corporation. That's what a corporation means. Now, in addition, I don't believe in anything should function for the benefit of so-called society. Society is just individuals. I believe that everything should function for the benefit of protecting the individual rights of the individuals. And by the way, what happens in the end is society as a whole is better off. But nothing should be guided by what's good for society, because I think that's a meaningless statement. I don't think there is such a thing. And as a consequence, what you need to do is protect the individual rights of workers. So they shouldn't be, nobody has a right to force people to work where they don't belong, where they don't want to. Nobody has a right to force people to do things they don't want to do. But employment is a voluntary contract. People engage in it voluntarily, and it can be severed voluntarily. And as a consequence, shareholders have a right to employ anybody they want, and they have a right to fire anybody that they
want. But there's a fundamental flaw in that argument you're on, and that is that employment is a voluntary contract. In a society where the only way to put food on the table, the only way to provide health care for your children, the only way to make sure that your children are able to go to school, in a society where the fundamental necessities of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness can only be acquired by having employment, employment is not voluntary.
Of course employment is voluntary. You can choose who will employ you. You can choose among many. Some are corporations, some are partnerships, some are the corner grocers. There's a wide variety of different employment opportunities. You have a choice which one to take. And look, producing something is not voluntary. That's true. You have to put food on the table. That's part of life. That's nature.
But the world you're describing, Iran.
People are productive. They're successful. And to the extent that they're not successful.
But the world that you're describing, where there is no democracy, either in government or in the workplace, and where the shareholders have the greatest say, those with the greatest wealth will become the shareholders with the greatest power. And eventually we have a society that is run of, by, and for nothing but the wealthy elite, and everybody else down at the bottom is basically the peons.
But that's not true, because the fact is that capitalism, and it came close to its pure form in the 19th century, brought about the existence of the middle class. The middle class was created by capitalism.
There was almost no middle class during the 19th century outside of the farm.
Capitalism created the middle class in England and in the United States. It is capitalism that has raised the standard of living in the poor like no other system.
It's government history. Intervention that has here on.
No,
it's minimum wage laws, maximum hour laws, child labor laws.
Is what has
the right to organize. We had very little middle class during the Golden Age.
Government intervention and the so-called legal rights of unions have slowed down that process. The closer you get to pure capitalism, the more social wealth mobility you have in society, the more government intervention you have, the more unions have power, the slower that mobility becomes, the less able are the poor to become rich and the rich to become poor. It goes in both directions. And when you have the closer you get to capitalism, the more of that mobility exists.
No, the more capitalism is absolutely unrestrained, the more rigidified society is going to become, because the more accumulated wealth is going to be in smaller and smaller number of hands. Well, this is our fundamental disagreement. And
absolutely.
And as you say, you don't believe in democracy, and I do, and there we go. AynRand.org, AynRand.org. Yaron Brook, the president and executive director of the Institute, thank you so much for being with us, Yaron. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program. Well, there you have it. Don't believe in democracy. Yes, indeed. Bush's policies are weakening the National Guard, say the governors. We'll be getting to that as we go on. By the way, the Bush administration has also been doing soft shoe, the dance, as it were, on this sham Dubai compromise. Here now, the Bush administration has said, okay, we're going to have a 45-day investigation. We're going to have a 45-day investigation. However, it's going to be done in secret. The report, when it's finished, is going to be done in secret. Now, by the way, the company has come out and said, we'd like you to do this, after a little winking and nodding from the White House. So they're going to have an investigation in secret. They are going to generate a report in secret. And the only people who get to see the report are Bush and Cephas, the committee that determines whether or not these things are okay. Well, some in Congress, and increasingly, and you can see this over the weekend, increasingly Republicans in Congress are saying, oh, this is fine with us. I mean, those Republicans who want to suck up to the president are saying, cool, 45 days, maybe this will go away. Maybe there'll be an earthquake someplace. Maybe, the God forbid, maybe there'll be a hurricane someplace. Maybe there'll be a typhoon. Maybe war will start in Iran. Maybe the American people will get distracted. Maybe Britney Spears will get married. You know, something will happen. Maybe another white girl will vanish in Aruba. Something will happen to take this off the headlines of America, and then they can just kind of quietly do it in the night. Well, Chuck Schumer, the Democrat from New York, and others are having no part of it. As he said this morning on Good Morning America, he said, I'm not sure we have a truce. Our legislation, which is bipartisan, 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans, will introduce it today on the floor of the Senate, says do the 45-day review that's necessary, but it also says give Congress, not just the president, the findings, and let Congress have an opportunity, 30 days, to disapprove the deal. That's what's needed, because the president has already decided. He says he's for it, and so he has the verdict already, and now he's having the trial. You get this? Bush has already said he's in favor of the poor deal, and so now he's going to have his own private group do a secret investigation, report back to him, and then he's going to tell us what he told himself about whether or not he should do what he's already said he's going to do. A lot of folks kind of scratching their heads going, this just doesn't quite smell right. And as I have said before so many times, if you look at the consequences, if you look at the consequences of our international trade policies, what you see is exactly what is happening right now in Dubai. The situation in Dubai is just absolutely it. And before I move on with that, and I also want to get back to David Sirota's notes about the Corporatist Manifesto, and also a federal judge today slapping down the Bush administration on this. This thing may be coming unraveled, or they may be tightening it up. We'll see how it plays out. But first, just apropos of our last guest, Tom in Minneapolis, I know, wants to comment on Yaron Brooks' comments. Yeah, I am, and you are too, Tom.
Hello.
Tom, can you hear me? Tom in Minneapolis. Tom is gone. Well, I guess we still have some work to do on our board, figuring out how people can listen to us. In any case, we'll get back to this. EconomyInCrisis.com lays out the details of how all this stuff works. They just lay it right out. And here is foreign ownership of our industries in the United States. Last week you heard me read a list of some of the names of some of these companies. This is from EconomyInCrisis.com. And it's all based on federal government statistics. Here are the percentages of ownership by foreigners, foreign governments, foreign individuals in America. 97% of our sound recording industries are now foreign-owned. 79% of our commodity contract dealings and brokerage industries are now foreign-owned. 80% of our ports operations are now foreign-owned. 75% of our motion picture and sound recording industries are foreign-owned. 65% of our metal ore mining is foreign-owned. 64% of our motion picture and video industries. 64% of our wineries and distilleries. 63% of our database directory and other publishers. 63% of our book publishers. 62% of our concrete companies. 75% of the companies that make engines, turbines, and power transmission equipment are foreign-owned. 53% of our rubber product manufacturing in the United States is foreign-owned. That would be mostly tires, although a lot of other things. 53% of the non-metallic mineral product manufacturing is foreign-owned. 52% of our plastics manufacturing and our rubber products manufacturing, foreign-owned. 51% of all plastics products manufacturing, foreign-owned. 51% of our insurance industry is foreign-owned. 50% of our boiler tank and shipping containers, foreign-owned. 48% of our glass and glass products, foreign-owned. So it shouldn't surprise us that insane trade policies being pursued for 25 years have caused us to have to sell off our country, and now we're having to sell off our ports as well. Gee, what a surprise. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Cheney's got a gun.
Uh-oh.
Dick Cheney shot someone. Cindy Sheehan better run. Better watch her liberal buns.
And welcome back, my friend. My friends. 34 minutes past the hour at the Tom Hartman radio program. So much happening. It's just absolutely remarkable. Over the weekend here we had William Kristol, Bill Kristol, talking about how we really haven't had a serious three-year effort to fight a war in Iraq. Just get this. This was on Fox News, Bill Kristol.
So what do you do about the terrorists?
Kill them.
Well, defeat them. Well, we've been trying, and our soldiers are doing terrifically, but we have not had a serious three-year effort to fight a war in Iraq as opposed to lay the preconditions for getting out.
Just kill them, he says. Yeah, just kill them. That solves everything, right? Instant solution. Just kill them. Except for the fact that the more we do what we're doing, the more terrorists we seem to be creating. And rather aggressively, but I might add. So this is just mind-boggling. We have not had a serious three-year effort to fight a war in Iraq. Well, actually, we did have a serious war. And when George W. Bush came out and on that aircraft carrier declared hostilities over.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
When Bush came out and said that...
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Yeah, right. Now, see, okay, there's two pieces there. The first part, when Bush said, you know, we've won the battle, we've defeated the Iraqi government, he was right. It took us, what, a couple weeks to bring down the Iraqi government? He was right. And then when he tried to say it had something to do with 9/11, he was lying. Well, you know, we all know that. This is no secret. But here's where the not right part comes. Bill Kristol saying, we have not had a serious three-year effort to fight a war. No, we haven't, because for 3 years we haven't had a war in Iraq. What we have had is an occupation. And there's a difference. When you're occupying a country, you're not at war with that country. We are supposed to be trying to rebuild that country. It is not a war in Iraq. It's an occupation of Iraq. And an occupation, a military occupation, if you look back over thousands of years of history, what you find over and over and over again, whether it was the Roman Empire, or the Greek Empire, or the Russian Empire, or the American Empire, or the British Empire occupying North America, for example, when you have an occupation, ultimately what happens is people stand up and say, no, we don't want to be occupied, thank you very much. And that's what's going on. Or that's what's been going on up until now. And by the way, during those 3 years, the Bushies tried to do in Iraq the same thing that they're trying to do with this Dubai port deal right now, which is impose a capitalist-run government rather than a democratically-run government on the Iraqis. You know, banning labor unions, going to a flat tax, saying that any corporation can come into the country and do anything they want, and they can expatriate, they remove from the country all of their profits, and nothing has to be done for the benefit of the citizens of Iraq. And these guys really and truly believed, when they went into Iraq, they really and truly believed that they were going to be able to create a paradise, a utopia, a conservative utopia. They really believed that it had never been tried before. The ideas that, for example, Yaron was talking about earlier, or that conservatives in general talk about. That we should simply do away with the whole New Deal thing and anything that resembles it in Iraq.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And so they aggressively did something about that in Iraq. I mean, to the extent that Roosevelt-type policies were in place in Iraq, doing away with the social safety net, doing away with welfare programs, doing away with free public health. It's not altogether done away with, but it's moving in that direction. Doing away with entire sectors. Doing away with labor unions. Selling off over 200 state-owned industries and to private foreign corporations in many cases. Putting the country up for sale. And they really, these guys, these true believers, they really and truly believed that something good was going to come out of this. They really did. And they were just tragically wrong. I mean, you could look back at history and see that every time we've tried to do something like this, like what these guys are trying to do in Iraq, the economic experiment that they tried to do in Iraq, every time in the past we have tried to do that, that the consequence has been the world very similar to that characterized by Charles Dickens. I mean, Dickens in A Christmas Carol, Mr. Scrooge, may I have another lump of coal?
No, you may not. It'll cost me a pence. Get back to work.
I've already put in 10 hours today.
I need another 2 hours of work now.
May I have some money for health care for my son, please, Mr. Scrooge?
No, you may not.
I mean, it's pretty simple. Pretty straightforward. So the economic part of it crashed and burned, and without the support of the economic part of it, a middle class in Iraq did not reemerge. There was arguably a fairly strong middle class in Iraq prior to 1991, but now Iraq is a poverty-riddled country with over 50% unemployment. And as a consequence of that, you cannot have a democracy. When you have a nation that is racked by poverty and you hold an election, the person rising to the top is going to be the person who's the most effective demagogue. The person who is offering people a way out. And you're not going to have a functioning democracy. It won't work. It just won't work. And so what happened? Well, you had three sects in Iraq, and this is so similar to what happened in Lebanon, by the way, when there was a power vacuum there. You had different sects in Iraq, and they are now starting to go to war with each other, the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Kurds. The Kurds are pretty much staying out of it. They're just going to retreat to the north and say, this is ours. I mean, they may have a battle over Kirkuk, but they're just saying, this is ours. But one of the things that I noted in today's paper, there was an article I was talking about how, in the New York Times, about how essentially ethnic redistribution is happening right now as we speak. People living in mixed neighborhoods in Baghdad, where there's some Sunnis and some Shia living in the same neighborhood, the Shia are moving out of the predominantly Sunni neighborhoods, moving into Shia, predominantly Shia neighborhoods, and the Sunnis are moving out of the predominantly Shia neighborhoods into the Sunni neighborhoods. People are swapping houses. Because what you're going to see is the enclavization of Iraq. I mean, this is what we saw in the Balkans. This is what we saw in Lebanon. This is what happens when civil war happens. And the civil war, I would suggest to you, is already well underway. John in Burlington, Washington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, sorry about that. What you just got done saying, I think it was a big mistake going into Iraq, but I think these people, I don't think so much they consider it a mistake. Hello?
Yeah.
I think it was a planned chaos. So the people that are making all the money on that chaos and are taking over that country could.
I really don't. I don't believe that, John. I think that they thought that they could bring in Halliburton and KBR, and within 2 or 3 years they'd have Iraq rebuilt, and it would be a paradise, and they'd have this flat tax, and they'd have no unions, and they'd have free trade, and the economy would be humming like Hong Kong, and they'd be able to say, see, this is what we should do in America. We should do away with Social Security. We should do away with Medicare. We should privatize everything, just like we did in Iraq, because see how well it works? Because that's what the Democrats have been doing ever since we did that with Germany and Japan in the 40s, and it's been so successful, and the Republicans wanted to have their example that they could point to.
Yeah. The other point, though, going to Dubai, because that's why I was really calling,
sure.
And that is, have you guys talked about the fact that the van that carried the explosives in the explosion in Lebanon that took out that terrorist attack that took out, I can't remember the guy's name, in
right.
Lebanon.
The former
actually,
prime minister, yeah.
Yeah, it actually came through Dubai via, it was stolen in Japan and came through Dubai, and the investigation, the UN investigation hasn't really, because Dubai hasn't given them the paperwork, and my point in that is, the whole point of this deal, what they're giving these guys is this paperwork is not going to be in America. Something like that could happen here, and they'd have the paperwork and say, oh, well, we don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
and the fact is Dubai is a fascist nation. It's an Islamo-fascist country, and that's what these guys are into.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all. It's
if you take a look at who's at what's going on, it's just like right now in history. How was it that Mussolini came to power, Hitler came to power, etc. And what did they do?
In both cases, Mussolini and Hitler came to power out of economic distress.
What's that?
They came to power out of economic distress. What you had was the disaster of World War I, particularly in Germany because of the Treaty of Versailles. The country was in economic ruins. And
we're creating that.
Yeah, absolutely. In Iraq, absolutely. We are. And but I really don't think that the Bushies intended this. It's just what could have been predicted. But they were so blinded by their ideology that
They're also creating it in America.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's destructive to democracy in America as well. John, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
George Bush, don't lie. George Bush, don't lie.
sure did.
George Bush told lies.
He told lies.
George Bush wasn't nice.
He should apologize.
The deficit is flying sky high.
Why, oh why?
Now the well is running dry.
The White House lied.
Read my lips.
You told us all that things would be fine.
Read my lips.
I can't believe we bought that line. You know it came as no surprise. George Bush told us.
And welcome George back, Margaret. 51 minutes past the hour. Coming up about 9 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, on CNN. CNN keeps hiring these right-wingers as their pundits. They had Terry Jeffrey on, the editor of Human Events, over the weekend. And Terry, a paid shill to, excuse me, a paid political analyst for CNN, informed us that what's going on in Iraq right now is proof. Proof positive, my friends, proof that the Bush administration policies are working.
Terry, is Iraq falling apart right now?
Well, I certainly hope not, Wolf, but I think actually these attacks on these Shia shrines can be attributed to the potential success of the Bush strategy.
It's the success of the Bush strategy. Don't you get it? It's really working fine over there. Everything's going just the way we want it. We planned it this way. I mean, the question you have to ask yourself is, if the blowing up of the Golden Mosque in Samarra and the murder of Sunni imams and the murder of over 200 people and days of curfew and thousands, hundreds of thousands rioting in the street, if these are all indications of success, what would failure in Iraq look like? Perhaps Witt has a suggestion. Witt in Scottsdale, Arizona. Hey, Witt, welcome to the program. Oh, I can't. The board's not set up where I can. Okay, we got Witt on the line. Hey, Witt.
Anybody that would call somebody, my fellow American, a right-winger is my target audience. For if you call that progressive talk, I really, really pray for your demented soul. Truthfully, Tom. But how many people died under the...
Your prayers are appreciated, Witt.
Without any attempt at blaming the United States for putting them in power, how many innocent human beings died under the Saddam Hussein occupation of Iraq, and how many of his willing henchmen are responsible for the murder of over 2,000 Americans and the unfortunate and untimely death of thousands of other Iraqis?
Wait, it was reported in the newspaper over the weekend that 700 or 800 people a week are showing up in the morgues in
Saddam Hussein murder in 30 years of occupation.
700 or 800 people a week are showing up in the morgues right now, Witt, in Iraq, with evidence that they have been drilled with electric drills, burned with cigarettes, and things like this. I mean, it's really a substantial problem. And, no, I don't know how many people on any particular given week or month, while Saddam was in charge, ended up in similar situations. But my guess is if it was anything like it is right now, there would have been a revolt.
Really?
Yeah.
Just like there was a revolt by Jewish people that were being carted off to Auschwitz, which, by the way, we should have been stopped while we knew it was happening.
I think any attempt to draw a parallel between Saddam Hussein's regime...
Either way you want to look at it.
I think any attempt to draw a parallel between Saddam Hussein and what's going on in Iraq is and Germany, I'm sorry, is just absolutely disingenuous. How will you know, since you're so knowledgeable about this, Witt, how will you know that we are succeeding in Iraq?
How will I know?
Yeah.
Once people that Cindy Sheehan calls freedom fighters stop trying to murder Americans trying to establish a peaceful nation in Iraq. Okay, do you realize the people they're trying to murder?
So you're saying that the way that we'll know that we have success is when the local people... Okay, you're not interested in a conversation with... You're trying to play Sean Hannity on me, and I'm just not going to do it. I'm sorry. You know, I let you speak. You try and filibuster me. That's it. It's rather pathetic, really. These guys, they watch Hannity or they watch O'Reilly or whatever, these pathetic right-wing shows, and think that, you know, that has something to do with human conversation and discourse. It's truly tragic. This from the news today, this from Reuters. The Bush administration was ordered by a U.S. federal judge, to explain why it did not give New Jersey officials documents and information Washington had about a deal allowing an Arab company to take over management of a container terminal in Newark. You get this? On Thursday, the state of New Jersey sued the federal government to block the deal on the grounds it violated the 10th Amendment, which says states control anything not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. And by the way, the 9th Amendment says we the people control anything not explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. Earlier, New Jersey Governor John Corzine urged the governors of states with ports affected by the deal, Louisiana, New York, Florida, Connecticut, Maryland, and Pennsylvania, to join the lawsuit. All of those governors except Jeb Bush have come out and expressed some serious reservations, some serious concerns about this. James in Los Angeles, California. Hey, James, what's up?
Hey, I think we have enough evidence now between the port deal, between Katrina, between everything else, you know, all those people showing up in morgues in Baghdad. It's not Iraq. It's the just Baghdad that over 1,000 people are showing up every week in those morgues, and 800 of them are
showing evidence of torture. I agree with you. This is the straw that is breaking the back of the Iraqis, just like the ports has awakened Americans. 57 minutes past the hour. Thanks for your call. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Viagra for your brain.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Welcome back, my friends. Paul Craig Roberts is a former senior research fellow at the conservative Hoover Institution, a former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, a former associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, a prolific and popular journalist. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I believe you've been a lifelong Republican. Is that an accurate characterization?
Well, no.
Oh, okay.
I've been a Republican. I think I'm an independent at the moment.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah.
And I voted for Democrats twice.
Okay. Twice, okay. So up until recently. Paul Craig Roberts, you wrote a piece a week or so ago that absolutely captured my attention. Conservatives endorse the Führer principle over our leader über alles. Deutschland über alles, of course, Germany over everything else or everybody else was the slogan or one of the marching slogans of the Third Reich. In fact, the Horst Wessel song, which has that phrase in it, Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles, is now it's a felony to sing that song out loud in Germany. You can't even whistle a tune. And
oh, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is.
What kind of a free country is that?
Well, I don't know. You know, it's just like Vienna just tossed this Holocaust denier in jail in Austria. You know,
it's ridiculous.
I don't disagree with you, but both of these countries are dealing with an extremely painful history, so. In any case, you lay out in this article the story of the Conservative Political Action Conference. Bob Barr, Congressman Bob Barr, who I know and who's been on this program a few times, and I've had beers with at Manny Maloof's Tavern in Atlanta back when he was in Congress and I lived in Atlanta, and he represented our state at that time. Very conservative congressman, one of the people who led the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton, that Bob Barr stood up at the Conservative Political Action Conference and said that questioning Bush or being loyal to the Constitution is not an indication of disloyalty to George Bush. And the response shocked you.
Yes, he was there having a debate with a Vietnamese immigrant who was one of the authors of the Patriot Act, Viet Dinh. And, of course, Bob Barr has led a lot of opposition to the Patriot Act and has been influential in keeping it from being worse than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And they were debating whether or not we were still under a rule of law, or we being governed by Bush, as by the whims of men. And Viet Dinh's position is that conservatives in a time like this can't afford to be skeptical of their leader. And Bob Barr's position was that we always have to stick to the rule of law and not allow an executive to claim that he has got powers above statutory law. And the audience was very much partial to the Vietnamese immigrant Viet Dinh's position that Bush could be trusted with whatever power that he wanted.
So here we had the Conservative Political Action Conference basically, by audience response anyway, taking the position that our leader, right or wrong, we will follow him, not the law, not the Constitution.
Yes, and I think exactly what the position was is that we won't be distrustful if Bush says he's got to have more and more powers. We'll let him have these powers, and if he says he's immune from congressional statutes such as the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, then that's all right with us.
Now, it seems to me that traditional conservatives, and the Barry Goldwater conservatives, I mean, even the old J. Edgar Hoover type conservatives, I mean, they would be horrified by this, by an idea like this.
Yes, they should be. As Bob Barr asked him, he says, are we losing our lodestar, which is the Bill of Rights, to the Bush's regime's zeal in the war against terror? So I think that Barr is correct. You see, America can't be destroyed by blowing up buildings. America's destroyed when you destroy the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the separation of powers. So Barr's position is correct. And Viet Dinh's position is obviously wrong, because what he is saying is, oh, the danger of the terrorists is so great, we have to have, a leader, a Führer.
Yeah. Do you, Paul Craig Roberts, I mean, you've been an observer of this scene for a long, long time, particularly the conservative end of it. Do you view the modern conservative movement and this kind of thinking that has so permeated it as being a threat to democracy in the United States and around the world?
It's clearly a threat to democracy. I've called them brown shirts, and they are certainly prepared to follow a Führer. And
what do we do about this?
That's a very good question. I think that the last chance we'll have to do anything about the Bush neoconservatives is in the November elections, and the Democrats are such a failure as an opposition party that I'm afraid they'll just turn off everybody, and the response of the voters will be just not to vote.
Yeah.
But what we really desperately need is to get one or both houses of Congress out of Republican control, so that at least there's a power basis for opposing the neocons. Mm-hmm. The Democrats may not use it, but at least it would be there, and they wouldn't any longer have the excuse that what can we do, we're a minority. So I think this November is really our last chance to correct it ourselves. If they don't...
Would it be an overstatement, Paul Craig Roberts, to say that the elections of 2006 may be one of the more important, one of the most important events in American history since the resolution of the Civil War?
Yes, I think it definitely is.
That would be an overstatement?
No, I don't think it would be an overstatement, because if the Republicans win the congressional elections and they come back again in total control of the government, they'll just simply say, see, the people approve of what we're doing. And they'll put more power in the executive at the expense of the other branches of government. And that's very dangerous. We'll end up with a soft dictatorship, you see, where the president is really not any longer subordinate to law.
Don't we have that to some extent?
It'll be an enabling act, like Hitler got after the Reichstag fire, in which his decrees became law. And Bush is already doing that in his signing statements.
I was going to say, aren't we already there?
Well, we are and we aren't. We'll be there if something doesn't happen in November. We don't get at least one House of Congress in the Democrats' hands, not because they're any great deal, but just to stop the monolith.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Associated Press reported last week that down in one of the counties down in Florida found as many as 100,000 ballots might have been flipped in the 2004 election accidentally by the electronic voting machines. The Republicans in Congress have prevented Rush Holt's bill, which has signatures from both Republicans and Democrats on it, from even coming to the floor for a vote, a bill that would require a voter-verified paper trail and relative transparency in elections. And in various states around the country, in California now, is flipping back to these electronic machines after the former Secretary of State, Kevin Sheely, left, you know, who had stopped them. Am I putting on a tinfoil hat here to think that there's some correlation between the Republican embrace of electronic voting machines over the Democratic objections and their desire to hold power over the next term?
I think it's part of their plan. In my opinion, they clearly stole the last election with the electronic voting machines. It works for them, and as long as they can keep control of the election commissions, they'll keep stealing the elections. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I think these electronic voting machines override democracy. They basically just throw democracy out and turn us into some kind of a third world, dark African place, you know what I mean?
Yep. Paul Craig Roberts, a former senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, a former editor with the Wall Street Journal, a popular and prolific journalist. Paul Craig Roberts, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Great speaking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, the plot thickens. The White House today turned over 200, actually it was last week, we learned about it today, 250 pages of emails from Vice President Dick Cheney's office. Senior aides had sent the emails in the spring of 2003 related to the leak of covert CIA operative Valerie Plame Wilson. This in a report by Jason Leopold over on Truthout. The emails are said to be explosive and may prove that Cheney played an active role in the effort to discredit Plame Wilson's husband, former Ambassador Joe Wilson. It could have been Cheney. So, you know, when Bush is, I got no idea.
I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now,
This is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
The emails could prove that Cheney lied to FBI investigators when he was interviewed about the leak in early 2004. However, Cheney was not under oath when he was interviewed. Now, I thought lying to the FBI was a crime whether you're under oath or not. Maybe I'm wrong. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com on the line. What do you think, Victoria?
I think it's very naughty.
He deserves a spanking.
Yeah, definitely deserve a spanking. Unless you're going to enjoy it, in which case you deserve to have one withheld.
There you go, yes. Now, the emails also, this report says, show that the vice president spearheaded an effort in March of 2005 to attack Wilson's credibility and use the CIA to dig up information against him. And is this becoming big news in Washington, D.C.?
Well, it hasn't so far. It's kind of under the radar at the moment because of the Dubai ports deal. I think it will grow over the next several days if some of the contents of these emails leak out. I think it's partly not big news because nobody's terribly surprised that Cheney is implicated, but I think it's also a question of time. Sometimes stories just take a bit of time to filter through. But I think that, you know, if those of us in the press corps do start asking questions about this, of course we'll get no answers. But if you go to the vice president's office, once again, you're going to get no answers. It's almost impossible to find anything out unless there are deliberate leaks, which apparently there were in this case.
Yeah, so what's happening with the Dubai ports deal? We have, on the one hand, the administration saying that they've twisted they winked and nodded at the Dubai ports world, and the company now wants there to be a 45-day secret investigation, the results of which will secretly be given to George W. Bush, who will then tell us what the result of the investigation of his own deal was, and will tell us whether or not the conclusion that he's already come to is accurate or not. On the other hand, you got Chuck Schumer and nine other members of the U.S. Senate, five Democrats, five Republicans, saying no, Congress should have a say in this. Well, how's this going to shake out?
Well, my prediction is, based on nothing, but my prediction is that the secret part of this is going to have to go bye-bye, because that is one of the problems, not only with the administration, but with this deal anyway, that nobody knew anything, and nobody at this point trusts the Bush administration to have a secret review. They view this as all far too friendly, and even if they decide that the executive branch can do the review, and they may decide that, I don't know, but even if they decide that, it's going to have to be out in the open, and there's going to be no nodding and winking and nudging and nudging. It's going to have to be in the open. Otherwise, I do not believe the Congress will go along with this.
Interesting. And Schumer had said that he was going to introduce legislation on the floor of the House. Today is Monday, as I recall. They're not back in session until tomorrow.
No,
on the floor of the Senate.
Monday. Yeah.
So tomorrow is when all this stuff is going to happen.
Tomorrow this stuff is going to happen. Also, tomorrow and Wednesday, Secretary Chertoff, who didn't have a great week last week, is up before a couple of committees this week, because this week he's got to justify his budget.
Oh, my.
And I know, which is, but he might as well just turn himself into a pinata and be done with it.
Well, the Bush administration always has to have a fall guy, right? It never rises to the level of the multimillionaires and billionaires who run the Bush administration. It always has to, you know, settle somewhere down below. Brownie apparently has done us an interview with one of the networks that's going to be played tonight. Was it Brian Williams with NBC, I believe?
Oh, really?
They were promoting
really?
It last night. Yeah, that Brownie's going to name names. And this should be interesting. So it'll be interesting to see how what the fallout of that is with regard to Chertoff's testimony tomorrow.
Yeah, Brownie's gone rogue. This is not what they wanted him to do at all.
Well, but they weren't protecting him. I mean, they weren't. You know, they hung him out to dry when they could have, you know, given him a nice little job someplace for $250,000 a year and let him be a lobbyist or something.
Yeah, no, Brownie is definitely going to name names. Chertoff is, of course, being protected. The Katrina report that came out last week, the one put out by the administration, sort of says in a very passive way that mistakes were made, but names nobody who made any mistakes. So apparently the mistakes just made themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Now Bush is back on the road selling his various programs.
Yes, he's going to India, actually, on Wednesday, India, and then to Pakistan. Bush is very hopeful about this trip to India, although it is actually fraught with peril. There are a lot of missteps that you can make on a trip to India, but he sees India as a very important, the world's biggest democracy, making great steps in terms of high tech, but also in terms of its nuclear advances, and he's promised them nuclear assistance.
Oh, interesting. Plus, you know, they've taken a million or two of our jobs. So
there's that too.
He's going to visit people doing jobs that were formerly American employee jobs, so there's probably a certain sense of nostalgia there. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria. Great talking with you today. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Back to the real free speech zone, talk radio for the rest of us here at the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The Independent, the British newspaper reporting Iraq's death squads on the brink of civil war. The headline, most of the corpses in Baghdad's mortuary show signs of torture and execution. And guess who's being blamed? As Andrew Buncombe and Patrick Cockburn report, the Interior Ministry. The Interior Ministry, that would be sort of like our Justice Department, our Department of Homeland Security, what used to be the Justice Department, the Interior Ministry. Hundreds of Iraqis, this just published, hundreds of Iraqis are being tortured to death or summarily executed every month in Baghdad alone by death squads working from the Ministry of the Interior. The United Nations outgoing human rights chief in Iraq has revealed. John Pace, who left Baghdad 2 weeks ago, told The Independent on Sunday that up to three-quarters of the corpses stacked in the city's mortuary show evidence of gunshot wounds to the head or injuries caused by drill bits or burning cigarettes. Much of the killing, he said, was carried out by Shia Muslim groups under the control of the Ministry of the Interior. What has happened now is that the Iraqi equivalent of the Department of Homeland Security, what we used to call the Department of Justice that controls the FBI, et cetera, the Federal Police Agency, the Department of the Interior, the Iraqi version of this, has come under the control of the Shia. And not just the Shia, it's come under control of what could be regarded as a rogue Shia. It's called SCIRI, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. This is the main Shia party. I mean, you put it all together. And in fact, Mr. Pace, the UN inspector, he said, the Ministry of the Interior is acting as a rogue element within the government. We've seen this before. I mean, we've seen this in countries all over the world. This is a very, very bad sign. He goes on to point out, Buncombe and Cockburn in this piece in The Independent point out that the Ministry of the Interior is controlled by the main Shia party, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, SCIRI. The Interior Ministry, Bayan Jabir, is a former leader of SCIRI's Badr Brigade militia, one of the main groups accused of carrying out sectarian killings. Another is the Mehdi army of the young cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. We might remind you that it was al-Sadr's men, the Mehdi army, who killed Casey Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan's son. Remember that period of time there when Bush said, we're going to take out Muqtada al-Sadr? He's not going. He's not with us, so he's against us. Right? It must be that he had turned evil, right? Or maybe he had turned good. I think in Bush's world, if you're with us, you're evil, and if you're against us, you're good. Is that right? I'm not
either
recalling.
With us or against us. You're either evil or you're good.
Right. You're with us or against us. You're evil or you're good. So if you're with us, you're evil, and if you're against us, you're good. So in any case, Sodder was against us, so he must have been good. And so we decided to say that we were going to try to arrest him, and he fought back, and his guys were fighting back against the USGIs, and that's when Casey Sheehan got into that fight and was killed by Sodder's men. Well, now Sodder apparently has become with us, so he must be evil, and he is now part of the Shia coalition that's trying to form a government after winning the elections in December. So he's now part of the government. And the big problem is that the Badr Brigade, this guy controls his own private army of a couple hundred thousand people. I mean, he's one of the... What's happening now is that because the neocons from America went in and said that companies no longer need to pay decent salaries, there's a flat tax of 15%, that it's the conservative paradise. The corporations run everything. Halliburton makes the rules, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That the institutions of civil society, government, has broken down to the point where people no longer look to government for things like medical care or safety in the streets. And so what has stepped into that void, now what the cons hope will step into that void in the United States, of course, are for private for-profit corporations, but what has stepped in, and that's what they thought would happen in Iraq, but it ain't working. Because the private for-profit corporations say, hey, we're about making a profit. When people are killing people, it's not so profitable. We're out of here. So what has stepped into that void are the religious zealots. So you've got Murtada al-Sadr, and he's feeding people. Well, let's go back to the beginning. He is this, you know, famous Shiite cleric. He's got this giant mosque. All kinds of people come to the mosque. And what do? They tithe. They tithe in Islam, just like people tithe in Judaism and in Christianity. They give part of their income, part of their money, to the mosque. And what does Sodder do with that money? He's running feeding centers, he's running schools, and he's fielded an army. And if you live in those areas that Sodder controls, and you're loyal to Sodder, then you have relative safety and security. So he has taken the place of government. And so there's, you know, he's got a couple hundred thousand guys who are drawing a small paycheck from him. They can eat at his places. They go to his mosque. Their families are protected. And they are the ones who showed up, and he gave them permission. He said, do you want to join the Iraqi army? Go ahead and do it. Let the Americans pay you a salary too. So they joined the Iraqi army. But where's their real loyalty? They joined the local police departments, but where's their real loyalty? Well, as they report in The Independent, more than 110,000 policemen and police commandos under the ministry's control are suspected. This is the Ministry of the Interior. This is the bunch that is causing the mortuaries, the morgues, to be filled up. The pattern, with these bodies, with these tortured bodies. Many of the 110,000 policemen and police commandos under the ministry's control are suspected of being former members of the Badr Brigade. Not only counterinsurgency units such as the Wolf Brigade, the Scorpions, and the Tigers, but the commandos and even the highway police have been accused of acting as death squads. And then they go on to point this out. You know, much of the statistical information provided to the UN, Mr. Pace, the UN, and his team, comes from the Baghdad Medico-Legal Institute, which is located next door to the city's mortuary. He said figures show that last July, the morgue alone, in just July, the morgue received 1,100 bodies, about 900 of which bore evidence of torture or summary execution. I guarantee you, even at the worst of it, this mortuary was not seeing this kind of stuff coming out of Saddam Hussein's regime. Why? Because he was so efficient at terrorizing people. He didn't have to kill people. He had them scared. Much of the killing, they say, was carried out by Shia Muslim groups under the control of the Ministry of the Interior. Now, you know, most of the charges against Hussein are around two events. One was the gassing of the Kurds in the north, which, according to at least one CIA report, may have been done by Iraq The Kurds were basically caught in the crossfire between Iraq and Iran in the war. Iraq to the north, Kurdistan to the north, Iran to the Iran to the north, and Kurdistan to the north, Iraq to the south. And the other being after 91, at the end of the war, when we pushed Saddam Hussein's men back up into Iraq out of Kuwait, and then followed them on the highway of death and killed 100,000 of them or so from the air, just gratuitously, that after George Herbert Walker Bush did that, he sent a signal through the media to the Shia in the South that if they rose up, we would stand with them. And they did, and we didn't. And just like Abraham Lincoln did, now, not that I would draw any parallels between Abraham Lincoln and Saddam Hussein, but just as Lincoln did, you know, when people rose up in the South and said, you know, we're independent, he said, sorry, we're sending in the army, and they're shooting. And that's what Saddam did, and that's, you know, not a good thing, right? So, thus, all these deaths. Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake, we got 1 minute. What's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Good.
I'd just like to respond to what your guest, Craig Roberts, had to say. I believe we are in a constitutional crisis. The Bush administration clearly does not care about our civil liberties. They're doing everything they can to do away with our Bill of Rights, including the Fourth Amendment, with having the NSA spy on us domestically. We need to get to the bottom of what the Bush administration is doing with our Constitution.
And the only way we can do that, Jake, is if you and I get sufficiently politically active that Democrats can take control of the House of the Senate and the Senate in 2006, and that it's such a resounding and overwhelming victory that even rigged voting machines and people thrown off voter rolls by people like Ken Blackwell can't cover it up.
Absolutely, Tom. The Republicans have to be tossed out of office because they cannot be allowed to destroy this nation.
Yeah, to destroy it any further, because this has been going on for some time. Yeah, absolutely, Jake, absolutely. And the bottom line is people have to get politically active. Jake, you said it very well. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And we'll come back to your calls after this break. Our number, 866-440-8466, or drop by our live chat room, TomHartmann.com, and say hi to some of the finest minds in the whole entire Internet. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program for your daily minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And Ron was a whiz bang on the dial. Almost as big as Jesus.
It's the Enron song.
Catch your name. And they put it on the baseball park downtown.
Well, they're taking it off now.
Enron took my money. We lost it all, they say. With questionable accounting, I gutted my 401k. When the New York Times said the stock is dead, now the trial's begun. They'll be taking the fifth block, can it play? I got hosed by Enron.
We all got hosed by Enron. I'll tell you, my friends, we all got hosed by Enron. Especially here in Portland, where our utility is still owned by Enron, believe it or not. 51 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, you want to try it again?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to mention about the most powerful meme or thought virus that has been going on is this war on terror meme. When the Republicans hear that, they link that immediately to Iraq. and liberals usually thinking of Al-Qaeda or Afghanistan.
Oh, this goes way, way back here, Tom. Just listen to this. This is Bush declaring hostilities over. I played this earlier in the program, but it bears repeating.
Mm-hmm. My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Now he's gonna do the conflation. He's gonna pull them together right here.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror,
right,
that began on September 11th, 2001.
There you go, right there.
Now Rove's speech 2 weeks ago, when he launched the 06 campaign, when he said the Dems have a pre-9/11 mindset and the cons have a post-9/11 mindset.
Right.
What the Dems should respond to is, wait a minute, no, our pre-9/11 mindset. We have a mindset of 9/11, Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda, Osama. They have 9/11 Iraq mindset, and that's how we should play it, because that's their game plan, is to keep linking Iraq with terror. First of all, that's a tactic. You can't declare war against a tactic. But
here's what I think is a larger meme, Tom. I think it would require an organized effort. I think that whenever somebody says that everything changed on 9/11, the response should be, you are spitting in the face of the founders of this country. James Madison, the man who shepherded the Constitution through the Constitutional Convention, wrote the minutes of the Constitution, wrote the first draft of the Constitution, ended up President of the United States in 1812, when the British invaded this country, marched all the way to Washington, D.C., and burned the White House. James Madison and his wife Dolly had to flee the White House because a foreign army had invaded and burned down the White House. And you tell me that 9/11 is the first time this country has ever had any foreigners come and attack us? Come on.
Right, but that's a long meme.
Well, I think it can be shortened up. I think, you know, it needs to be repeated a whole bunch of times. But the fact of the matter is that James Madison didn't see it necessary to suspend the Fourth Amendment in order to protect the United States. And they had just burned down the White House.
Well, I know. And I've seen Dean on the talk shows when they say, you know, war on terror. Dean has stopped and said, you're talking about Afghanistan, right? And well, what do you mean? Well, you said war on terror, Afghanistan, right?
Yeah, because they're, you know, the war on who?
Well, yeah,
on Osama.
You haven't found the SOB, right? But these guys keep linking it, and I don't know why the Democrats aren't, you know. Well, our only pre-9/11 mindset is peace and prosperity and surpluses and jobs. That's my
That's another good one. That's another good one. Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's a good one. That's great. Joe in Atlantic Heights, New Jersey. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Listen, first let me thank you for having Paul Craig Roberts on.
Oh, sure. He's been on the program before, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Has he talked about jobs and outsourcing on your show before?
Perhaps about a year ago.
Well, it's probably good to have him on for that again, too.
Yeah, the guy is brilliant. I mean, he really knows his stuff, and he's been in the middle of the beast for a long, long time.
Well, he's on the right, and we have a lot of common ground with a lot of people on the right, and
That's right.
It's great that your show points that out.
Well, and what's happened is that a lot of people on the right who are of ethical and principled people, like Paul Craig Roberts, are stepping up and saying, I've had enough of this. And like he said on this program today, he's actually voted for Democrats.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration.
Right.
Anyhow, we only have a minute here before
show
wraps up.
My main point, though, listen, this is about a week old, but the Times of London, last week, Sunday Times, this is an editorial. The title is, Bush and Blair have brilliantly done Bin Laden's work for him.
Yes.
And I think everybody should look up that article. Go to Times.
Yeah, no, this is the point that I've been making on this program for 3 years, Joe.
But I think that's the meme that covers them all. And why has America been so stupid to do Bin Laden's work for him? It's because we have 90% of our collective brain tied behind our back as long as Bush and the neocons shut out every opinion that doesn't agree with theirs.
Well, it's partly that, and it's partly that the corporate takeover of our media has turned our what used to be a fairly efficient system of delivering information to people into an entertainment machine.
Yeah.
Our TV these days is more like a video game than like TV. I mean, it's designed to it's a soporific. It's not an informational device.
Absolutely.
And that is the direct consequence of two very specific legal actions. One was Ronald Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and stopping shooting down all the provisions that were associated with the Fairness Doctrine, and the other is Bill Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act. And, you know, if pre-11-9 said, if we could just go back to the way America was in 1980, we would be, and we can legally, I mean, we could go back to having those laws in place. You would have such a stronger, more vibrant democracy. You'd have 25% of the workforce employed in union jobs instead of only 8%. We could do it. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Doug Cunningham is a producer for the Workers' Independent News, laborradio.org, the website. Doug has news director, reporter, anchor, UPI, and AP award-winning news experience, both commercial and NPR member stations in Michigan and Indiana. Welcome to the program, Doug.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be with you again.
Wanted to just get into what's happening with labor these days. First of all, there was an announcement apparently made today about the National Education Association and the AFL-CIO.
Yeah, that's right. They're making the announcement in a couple of minutes, actually, the formal announcement. They are launching what they call a labor solidarity partnership agreement between the NEA, which, of course, is the large teachers union that's currently not affiliated on a national level with the AFL-CIO. And the AFL-CIO and the NEA are going to be affiliating on a state and local level, NEA local affiliates affiliating with the AFL-CIO, and they say that that affirms the importance to them of a unified voice on behalf of America's working families. So some exciting news there. NEA is a big union, effective union, and it'll be boosting the AFL-CIO's power, and it'll be a mutually beneficial arrangement for the two organizations.
Yeah, and hopefully we'll continue the strength of the NEA. The NEA is really one of the stronger unions out there.
Oh, absolutely. And I have to stress that this does not mean that the national NEA is formally affiliating with the national AFL-CIO, but these local bodies of the AFL-CIO, very important. State Labor Federations, Central Labor Councils, they are the grassroots labor movement in this country in many respects, and they are very effective in mobilizing people, political lobbying, and get-out-the-vote efforts and that sort of thing. So this is a shot in the arm financially for the AFL-CIO, and also it boosts, I think, the power of both organizations when it comes to mobilizing and political clout.
Yeah. Back when I was a kid, you know, Doug, we're speaking with Doug Cunningham of laborradio.org, the Workers' Independent News. Back when I was a kid, there were several newspapers out of Detroit. I grew up in Michigan. And the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, one was the business paper, the other was the labor paper. One had a business section, the other had a labor section. All across America, there were competing newspapers. Now, as a consequence, in part, of Reagan stopping the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and other, you know, economic and political considerations, most cities only have one newspaper, and that one newspaper has no labor pages in it whatsoever anymore. Thus, I feel it's so important that on at least, you know, once a week on this program, we take an overview of what's happening with the world of labor. Labor Radio, Workers Independent News, laborradio.org. You guys are doing a great job of getting the word out on some radio stations around the country, and hopefully it'll continue to grow. Northwest Airlines bankruptcy. What's going on with this, Doug Cunningham?
Well, you know, they had a deadline last Friday. Supposedly they were supposed to make an agreement between the unions and with Northwest, which is in bankruptcy. The judge extended the deadline, so now they have until this Wednesday to come to an agreement. If these unions, there are three of them now, don't come to an agreement with the airlines, they could end up having their union contracts thrown out in bankruptcy court. Northwest has moved to do that in bankruptcy court in New York. And if they're thrown out, the unions will no doubt go on strike. And if they strike, that could kill Northwest Airlines. So the stakes are tremendous. The workers have given up hundreds of millions of dollars already. Northwest Airlines claims that they need $1.1 billion in concessions. The pilots union has given up $265 million already. The flight attendants have given up $195 million, but Northwest is still pushing for more, including outsourcing 30% of the flight attendant jobs. So we're watching that closely, and Wednesday, by the close of business, if there's no agreement there, the bankruptcy judge could take action on Northwest's motion to throw out those contracts.
Here's what totally baffles me, Doug Cunningham. The most heavily unionized airline in the United States is Southwest. They are also the most profitable airline in the United States. Why is it that all these airlines, when they get in trouble, the first thing they want to do is go after the unions?
That's a very good question.
What am I missing here?
Well, you know, Tom, we have a really, really perverse system here, because executives who manage these companies into bankruptcy, if that's the right word, managing them into bankruptcy, they're rewarded with bonuses, millions of dollars in stock bonuses, while workers are savaged. And what happens typically is the unions give up concessions, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of concessions. That, in turn, makes the stock price go up as the company emerges from bankruptcy. And when that happens, the executives reap these huge bonuses. It's a perverse incentive. I mean, actually, bankruptcy looks pretty good for corporate executives in many ways these days. And, you know, that's something that has to change, because instead of giving executives bonuses, how about this? How about tying bonuses to job creation and maintenance of good jobs, or else the executives don't get bonuses, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are ways to structure these things that aren't so anti-working family.
Yeah, and it need not necessarily be a law. I mean, I would not certainly be opposed to a law that says a CEO can't earn more than, say, 100 times what his least paid employee is making. I mean, traditionally in the United States, from the founding of this country up until around 30 years ago, it was 30 times. And I believe in Sweden there actually is a law that you can't go more than 30 times. You know, you can't have more than a 30-to-1 multiplier. In the United States, in most universities, it's 20-to-1. I believe in civil service, it's 21-to-1, the maximum. But even in the absence of a law, what do we do to bring about a social awareness of this, so that when people look at a CEO who's got a huge salary, they don't look at them as, oh, isn't that cool, he's got a huge salary. They look at him as, this guy's a leech.
Well, exactly. I mean, and that's what it is. I mean, the way we do that, I think, is by getting the real news out about what's really happening. That's one way we can do it. And another way is for individuals themselves, whether they're in unions or not, to just activate themselves. And they become much more aware of these things. Seek this news out, you know, get a good picture, a clear picture of what's really happening, and then get active to oppose it, because it doesn't have to be this way. This is not inevitable. We can change this. And we at one time it was different. Now we are in the most sweeping assault on worker wages, benefits, and pensions ever, not only in the airline industry, but nationwide. And, you know, when these bankruptcy companies that go into bankruptcy, when they try to just throw out the contracts and impose whatever settlement they want on workers, you have to remember something, and I think of it just this way. Non-consensual sex is rape. Non-consensual labor relations is the rape of working families, and it just shouldn't be allowed.
Interesting metaphor. You've had some successes, or labor has had some successes recently.
Organizing successes, absolutely. In fact, the latest one was 6,000 Oregon child care workers, SEIU, successfully organized these workers. The governor there had to sign into law a law allowing collective bargaining in that case, and they did. AFSCME, another major union in that state, also organized 4,000 of them. The largest single success lately is probably the 49,000 child care workers organized in one fell swoop last year in Illinois. 10,000 more organized in Washington State, so there's a big campaign nationwide to organize child care workers. SEIU has also had some organizing success down in Houston. About 6,000 janitors organized there in one fell swoop. And believe it or not, the UAW has had some success in southern states at some labor parts or auto parts plants, trucking facilities, things like that.
Well, I think people are getting it, that they, you know, those old union jobs of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s before Reagan started busting the unions, those were pretty good jobs.
Yeah, they were very good jobs for working families, and good for the country, too. I mean, this is not just a special interest sort of thing that's just good for these union members, because it's good for the community, the small businesses in the community, you know, that reverberates throughout the economy. When a family has good, solid, middle-class income and can go out and spend that money to support other businesses in the community and to donate to charities and that sort of thing and to tithe to their churches and everything else, I mean, that's a good thing. That's a good thing for America. And people have got to start looking at it that way. You know, with labor costs, cutting labor costs, slashing wages for working-class families is not a good thing. It's not a good thing for the families. It's not a good thing for the country.
Well, it also destroys or reduces the level of desire consumption, you know, the desire for products and services, which then reduces business activity. I mean, ultimately, it's suicide. Labor is getting behind, and speaking of what's best for America, labor is getting behind Congressman John Conyers' universal health care bill, House Resolution 676. Tell me about that.
Well, there are various unions and locals around the country that are backing this bill, signing on to it. He's seeking sponsors in the Congress as well, and the number is growing. I don't know what the precise number is at the moment in Congress, but it's growing. And obviously labor is seeking to do something about health care because health care is in a crisis, and also because it affects bargaining so much. I mean, the huge cost of health care, skyrocketing costs, means that workers can't get wage increases. They have to struggle to hang on to their health care benefits. In many cases, companies trying to ship, you know, the cost onto workers. Conyers' single-payer health plan would help solve that by lowering the cost overall of health care in the country, also making sure the uninsured are insured, because having a large pool of uninsured also drives up labor costs. Health care costs. So these Conyers is trying to do this, obviously, with a Republican-controlled Congress. You know, he's probably not going to be able to get it through this session, obviously, but efforts are underway to build a critical mass to do just that, a universal health care bill that would cover everybody and would have a single payer.
This is a great story. We have about a half a minute left, Doug. An anti-union campaign going on?
Yeah, I don't like to give too much publicity to this sort of thing, but an outfit called the Center for Union Facts, which is really just a front group for big business, it's being used to bash labor unions in a multi-million-dollar national anti-union campaign. It's Rick Berman of Berman & Company is behind it. He's the same guy, by the way, who attacked Mothers Against Drunk Driving while he worked on behalf of his clients, the alcohol industry, has a long history of anti-labor work. And so if you hear that propaganda out there, be aware of where it's coming from and the fact that you shouldn't put too much credence to it.
There you go. Doug Cunningham with LaborRadio.org, the website, the Workers Independent News. Doug, thanks so much for being with us today and being on our program at the bottom of the hour every single day. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Been there, done that, I ain't looking back on the seas I've sown. Saving times, spending too much time on the telephone.
And welcome back, my friends, to the place where being progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a clean vote. How about that? We'd settle for that. Yeah, indeed. Because then we would end up in charge here. We really would, because we represent the point of view of the majority of Americans. It's just very simple. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Bob in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, you were just talking about corporate control and stuff like that. It's amazing the amount of corporate control that labor actually has now through the pension funds that we just don't seem to be leveraging.
How so? You mean the ability to invest pension funds in different places?
Well, and to manage them. I mean, you know, I talked to Sweeney probably 10 years about trying to get a group together to actually try to direct labor's people who sat on pension fund boards into directing corporations to more or less do what would be good for worker rather than necessarily good for the fund.
Yeah, the problem with this, Bob, is that...
Happened.
The problem is that the Supreme Court has ruled, in fact, it was quite some time ago. I mean, it was the Michigan Supreme Court that made the ruling, but it has stood because it hasn't been challenged at the federal level in a case against Henry Ford, of all things, that was brought by, as I recall, Mr. Dodge or Mr. Chrysler, back in the days when there were such misters. There was this case that said that the equity of the stockholders has to be the primary responsibility of corporate management, and that when corporate management operates to the benefit of anything other than increasing profit and increasing the equity of the stockholders, they're violating the law.
Well, and that's very true, Tom, except there are two sort of perspectives on this. The Japanese long-term perspective, as opposed to the fiduciary responsibility that says, put a dollar in my pocket today. I think that you can meet your fiduciary responsibility as a board member by taking a long-term perspective on what's going to happen with a corporation.
Well, that's what Henry Ford was arguing, and he lost.
It's definitely not time to make the argument again. I mean, we're running an office pool on which state will be the next one to fall to the sword of, gee, we thought it was a good vote count in the next election. So,
yeah.
The bottom line is, what are you going to do?
Well, what you're going to do is you get as politically active as you can. You get as many people involved as you can. You show up for campaigns. You support the candidates who are going to make change in America. You send them 25 or 50 or 100 bucks or whatever you can afford, $10. And
probably so. You know, we took that step after we were talking about health care. And, you know, I'd love to see health care separated from employment because it's just a death spiral.
Oh, yeah, and in fact, one of...
the legislature, we did that last year, universal health care. Our Republican governor vetoed it. Our Democratic Senate and House majority did not even meet to try to override his veto. But yeah, things are moving in that direction in some places. You should come on back for a while.
Yeah, well, I get out there from time to time. I've only been away 11 months. I lived there for 10 years.
Let's make it afternoons with Bernie, too.
There you go. Yeah, it actually is out there, isn't it? Bob, right, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Thanks for listening to us on WVAA there in Burlington. Much appreciated. Jeff in Colorado and Denver. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Two comments. One is this caller, Witt, who is calling you often. I'd just like to let him know, I think I can speak for a lot of the people listening to the show, we're all interested in making this world a better place, and we'd like, love to hear from people like him if he's got good ideas, and we'd like to cooperate and have discussions, not have this snide, arrogant, holier-than-thou attitude.
Well, the problem is Witt thinks it's about winning and losing.
Yeah, and it's like he speaks that he's a Christian, but one of the first things I learned about Christianity was humility.
Yeah.
And it's so please, Witt, we would like to talk to you. Let's have a dialogue, but please don't,
you said it better than I could. Thank you, Jeff.
Talk.
Thank you.
That's
not what you called about, though.
Yeah, the main thing is RFIDs. Last week you had Jim Harper from Cato.
Yeah. And the week before that, we had a woman on who has written a book about why Christians should be worried about RFIDs because they're the fulfillment of the beast.
Yes. Well, Jim Harper gave an indication that he didn't understand computers 101. In one basic thing, he said when he goes to the store, a lot of times he gives misinformation, like, say, when he's getting a club card from Safeway or whatever. He may be a Indian woman or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as long as there's any piece of information that is the same from transaction to transaction, you can trace it. I, for years, gave wrong Social Security numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, if you do, I looked at my credit report one time, and that wrong Social Security number came up in the right report.
In the right place, yeah, because they figured it out. They just cross-compare the stuff. So if you've got an RFID, a radio frequency identification chip, and, sewn into your clothes, and every store you go by happens to know who you are, or if you're standing out there in a protest and the Republicans or the police drive by and scan the crowd, they know who you are. They know everything about you, no matter how many phony things you've filled out.
But if he's using, say, wrong information for his club card, but then he uses his credit card,
yeah,
that fake Indian woman will be associated with his credit card. They'll be able to track it no problem, as long as there's any commonality.
I agree, Jeff. And thank you very much for the call and for pointing that out. In our next segment, coming out of the news at the bottom of the hour, I just got the news that Dennis Weaver just died. Dennis Weaver, the actor. Dennis Weaver was a very dear friend of mine. I wrote the foreword to his autobiography, All the World's a Stage. And about a year ago, I interviewed him on this program, and I'm going to play that interview as the next segment of this program, both as a tribute to Dennis Weaver, who passed away today at the age of 81, and as an informative piece. He was a great guest. It's 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hart.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S., a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way.
And welcome back. Just consider the song here.
And I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103. And I'll gladly park so close to you, when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
And welcome back. It's just a perfect piece of bumper music there. I let it run a little long. But the reason why is because our next guest is an old friend and a brilliant man, an absolutely brilliant man. Dennis Weaver won an Emmy Award for his role in television's longest-running series, Gunsmoke, over the past 5 decades. He's been on stage, television, motion picture. He founded the organization Life, Love is Feeding Everyone, and the Institute of Economics. And Dennis Weaver, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's always great to talk with you, Dennis. Let's talk about, you know, this little bumper music here about the SUVs and
I love that. I love that.
Wasn't that a hoot? I think Jim Turr did that. I think that came from BlueCanyonProductions.com. I may be wrong, but in any case, there's a lot of good stuff like that out there. But you have really taken the bull by the horns, an old metaphor. But anyway, you've really taken this thing on. You invented a word, Econonomics. And you've started this institute, and now you've created this website, DennisWeaverNow.com, to try and get folks involved in it. Tell us, what is Econonomics?
Well, Econonomics, of course, it's pretty obvious. It's a combination of ecology and economics. It's a word that I coined. It really represents the truth, Tom, that our ecology and our economy are absolutely interdependent. They're two sides of the same coin, if you want to put it that way. And for us to have a sustainable future, we need both of those to be sustainable. We need a sustainable environment, which supports, is necessary for human life, of course. And we also need a sustainable economy, which is essential for human welfare also. So we need both of those. And we have the way and the means to do that. We have the technology available. We have the technology that's on the horizon that can create new jobs. You know, the Economist magazine said something very profound. It said the environment may turn out to be the greatest opportunity for invention and enterprise that the industrial world has ever seen.
Yeah.
In other words, by saving the planet, by creating technologies that give us good jobs but do not destroy the place that we live, we can have a much better future.
You know, I've noticed, Dennis Weaver, DennisWeaverNow.com, the website there that you've created for this, I've noticed that many of our politicians talk about, and well, not just politicians, activists, right across the board, people talk about economic growth and the benefits of it as if that's a singular value, and then other people talk about sustainability as if that's a singular value. But I frankly can't remember a politician specifically speaking. I mean, even you know, the progressive folks like, you know, Ralph Nader, when I'm talking about the need to marry sustainability with an economic system that works, and that's what you're doing. Are you getting any traction? Are you finding politicians and people with the power to actually change policy who are realizing this epiphany that you had?
Well, you know, I've talked to a number of politicians, maybe not at the highest level that I should or would hope to talk to, but when you explain Econonomics, when you explain that it's a win-win situation, when you explain that it is necessary for us to save our environment and at the same time create jobs and create a stronger economy in doing it, there's very little argument against it. It's just a common sense philosophy, really. And I would just hope that more and more politicians could hear this message. That would be my hope.
Yeah, and that'll be driven, I think, from the bottom up, from people hearing the message on programs like
that's
this.
That's right.
Talk about it,
that's
know?
Right. And the bottom up is the way to do it. I mean, it'll never happen from the top down because they're entrenched in so many habits and ways of doing things that we've done in the past that they're so influenced by special interests that it'll never happen from the top down. It has to happen from the bottom up.
Yeah. Now, you talk about Econonomics as a word, as a movement, as an academic discipline, as a vision, and as a commitment. The academic discipline I find fascinating. Are you finding that colleges, universities, high schools, whatever, are interested in teaching this as a specific discipline?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we have a program at the Missouri Southern State University in Joplin that is going to be an example or that is an example that other colleges can pick up on and other high schools, because we've got to get to the young people and educate them and give them hope and a certain promise for the future, rather than so many of them are filled with despair and cynicism and apathy right now. And there's no reason for that. Well, there may be a reason, but there's also a big reason to know that we can do things in a better way, that we can create a better world for everybody. And we're teaching that at the Missouri Southern State University. We have a certificate program that is available now there. Well, actually, they've boosted it up to a minor, and it's on its way to a major that people can receive a major in economics. And it's just, we got to get to the young minds while they're still open, while they're not hardened by prejudices that they pick up along life's path. You know, the older we get, the more we're more reticent to look at new ideas and new thoughts and new ways of doing things. You know, it was Albert Einstein that said we can't solve today's problems with the same thinking that created them, the same consciousness.
Yeah.
So that's we've got to, while those young minds they're like sponges. If a young person sees an idea or hears an idea that makes sense to them, they say, okay, I'll go with that. So that's what we've got to do before they get just totally hardened with the old ways of doing things and just say, well, that's the way it is, and we're not changing anything.
And that's what you're doing, is changing these minds and waking people up. And you're doing a great job of this with the Institute of Economics. DennisWeaverNow.com is the website for it. And tell us about Angel's Nest in Taos, one of your pet projects.
Well, it's another example of how we can create jobs and live in harmony with nature. And Angel's Nest is the first economic health and rejuvenation yoga center, and we're using yoga as the means to create the economy, create jobs.
Yeah, but it could just as easily be a factory making electric pumps, couldn't it? I mean, I said it could just as easily be a factory making electric pumps or, the Ford.
Yeah, it could be, exactly. Yeah. We're just using yoga, but the exciting thing down there is this whole complex will be sustainable in an environmental way. We're creating one of the first hydrogen fueling stations down there. We're converting certain automobiles to hydrogen, and actually also to biodiesel, and a mixture of the two. And we're capturing our water because we have designed our buildings in such a way that we can do that. And water is going to be right now a very important issue around the world, because we're not only using it up faster than nature can store it for us, but we're polluting it at the same time.
Yeah.
So we're showing people that there is a way of designing things that will help us to have a sustainable life, a sustainable world, and one that is also, when I say sustainable, I'm talking about environment and economy both. Right now, we do not have a sustainable economy simply because the energy that we're using to support that economy is not sustainable. And, of course, I'm talking about fossil fuel, primarily oil.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is one of the major things that we've got to change, and that's what we're teaching, is that there are alternative fuel sources and advanced technologies that right now, if we use them, could free us from our dependence on foreign oil, which is causing so much havoc in the world.
Yeah, and not to mention a war in the Middle East and all this sort of stuff. We're talking with Dennis Weaver, the actor, activist, author of his autobiography, All the World's a Stage, and founder of the Institute of Economics. DennisWeaverNow.com will get you information, get you on the newsletter for that and the information on that. Dennis Weaver, just before we finish here, you and I have known each other for a couple of decades. You helped out with a Community for Abused Kids that Louise and I started 25 years ago, and for which I'm still very grateful. You helped with a fundraiser, several fundraisers on that. And about 7 years ago, I was working on a book called Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I just had reached a point where I had so much information about how the world was going to hell in a handbasket, and I was just feeling totally bummed out. And I called you up one day and said, how do you keep so optimistic? And you just gave me some wonderful advice. I wonder if you could just share with our listeners, because I get calls like this all the time from people saying, you know, it just seems like, you know, whether it's people saying, you know, George Bush is willing to lie, or, you know, big corporations are taking over, whatever, you know, pick your people are just in despair. So many people feeling powerless and in despair. And what's your response to that?
Well, I don't know what I said to you, actually, but it's pretty obvious to me that you can fall into the trap of being feeling despair and feeling cynicism and that sort of thing. But if you look around the world today, you can also see another force, and it's an incredible force. I think, in my mind, I'm well aware that there's a great wave of human energy that's totally unstoppable, that has seen what we've done to damage this earth and the place that we live, and are absolutely determined to correct that,
yeah,
to make this place what it can be. And you just got to take one day at a time, and you got to also get support from those that agree with you, so that there's strength in numbers. And that's what we're doing with the Institute of Economics also. I've got so many young people so eager to be part of this great movement, this great shift in the collective consciousness of the world. I've got so many of them really active at the Missouri Southern State University, for instance. It's so hopeful. It really is a very hopeful sign to me. I know the world, most people say, God, we're going to hell in a handbasket, but there's a huge force that wants to do the right thing,
yeah,
to make it a sustainable future for the kids and generations to come. And that's the force that's going to win.
Yep, and if each one of us just pushes our wagon, we'll get across this frontier, right?
Absolutely.
There you go. Okay.
You know, that shift in the collective consciousness of the world, as you are suggesting, that's an individual responsibility. We got to take care of ourselves, like how we treat each other, what is our connection with our families, how do we treat the guy that fixes our car, or the lady that does whatever she might be doing, whether it's working in a restaurant, serving you, or whatever. We just got to know that there's a connection between us and act as though that is a reality, because it is.
Yeah.
We are all connected in this world, and we've got to stop thinking of ourselves as being divided, because that's the consciousness we're in now, a consciousness of separation and division.
Yeah.
And we're moving towards a consciousness of oneness, a consciousness of understanding and kindness and love and peace.
We're all on this spaceship Earth together here, no matter
absolutely
how we're divided up. Dennis Weaver, thank you so much for being with us. Once again, the website, DennisWeaverNow.com, for information on the Institute of Economics and the great work that you're doing. Thank you, Dennis, for everything you're doing in the world. Good talking with you. And Dennis is, we're back live now. That was an interview I did with Dennis Weaver about a year ago. Dennis Weaver just passed away this Friday of complications of cancer at the age of 81. His website, Dennis Weaver Now, is down, but DennisWeaver.com is up if you want to learn more about Dennis Weaver. An extraordinary man. And also, you can pick up a copy of his book, All the World's a Stage. I wrote the foreword for it, so I've read it. It's a great book. 49 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A song will lift as the mainsail shifts and the boat drifts unto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Special thanks also to Mike Toth, who pulls together the clips like that out of our program and puts them into our archives, manages our archives. when Heidi came in about an hour and a half ago and handed me the news that just hit the wire that Dennis Weaver was dead, that he had died of cancer-related complications, which is usually the phrase that the chemo killed him, but who knows. And in any case, died of complications from cancer at his home in Colorado at the age of 81. When Heidi handed me that piece of paper, I just went to TomHartmann.com, went to our audio archives, which Michael maintains there, went to the master page, which lists every single piece in there, and just did a search for Dennis Weaver. And there it was, the show. That was recorded and played on the air. That was from our program almost 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago anyway, from August 25th, 2004. So just as an FYI. Anyhow, time now for actually Twilight Zone alert, a bit of Republican oddity behavior, yes. What's new? Texas Joe Barton, Republican from Texas, is downright mad at Citgo. Yeah, this is from Daily Delay at Blogspot. He's mad because when oil prices are at an all-time high, Citgo had the gall to start a program that offered heating oil to the poor in the Northeast at rates up to 60% below market price. How dare they charge less than market price? That's right, Citgo, and only Citgo, started an oil for the poor program so that those less fortunate than others could heat their home this winter. And now Texas Joe Barton, the great Republican from Texas, is so mad that he's demanding, according to the New York Daily News, that the company Citgo produce by tomorrow all records, minutes, logs, emails, and even desk calendars relating to Citgo's novel program of supplying discounted heating oil to low-income communities in the United States. How dare they? Barton wants this information, and he wants answers to these questions. How and why were the particular beneficiaries of this program selected, and whether the program runs afoul of any U.S. laws, including but not limited to antitrust laws? Yes, indeed, good old Texas Joe Barton, the Republican from Texas, seeing red here when it comes to Texas Citgo. How dare Citgo offer 60% discounts on home heating oil to poor people? It's just not American. Well, it might also have something to do with the fact that Joe Barton is second only to Tom DeLay among members of Congress in receiving money from the oil industry. And now, as Paul Harvey would say, you know the rest of the story. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, author Christina Page, how the pro-choice movement saved America and the war on sex. Charlotte Brody will be here talking about integrating ecological medicine into mainstream medicine, and, of course, the ports, and, of course, the war, that and more, and your calls right here tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, the true people's radio. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See ya.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.